Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hey everyone, and welcome to Raising Parents, the Parenting Science Insights podcast, produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We are champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I'm your host, Dina Sargent. Let's get started. Hey guys, and welcome back to another episode. Now, we are often bombarded with ads and different kind of promotions on what healthy looks like. I definitely feel confused by the different guidelines sort of expected upon us, from habits to fitness and even what healthy eating is supposed to look like. There's so much that it can easily get lost with our kids in what we're supposed to be teaching them and how we're supposed to be setting an example. Now, that's a quick look into our discussion today. We are joined with clinical psychology doctoral candidate, Devanshi Patel. Thank you so much, Devanshi, for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Dina. It's nice to be here with you.
Now, with your work looking into the stigma of obesity, what is your role in helping families address that kind of stigma?
Yeah, so as a doctoral student, I wear many hats, essentially. And so part of that is doing research on stigma and stereotypes with a particular focus on parental stigma and childhood obesity. And then on the other side, I also work in clinics with families and children on a variety of presenting concerns, which include weight management, but also anxiety, behavior management, depression, among other things.
Well, that's incredible, especially when it comes to that stigma. There's that huge, I think we were talking about this before we started recording as well, when it comes to what society is expecting from us, and it sort of ends up being what we expect from ourselves quite often. And if we're feeling that way as adults, what are kids supposed to feel? And especially with the availability of so many different views of different body types and advertisements only using one particular body type. And this is so much around, okay, this is what healthy looks like, this is what unhealthy looks like. But there really isn't a black and white, as we adults, some of us adults know, but kids aren't usually really well aware of the whole, okay, there are so many different gray areas when it comes to body type, when it comes to healthy. And so it's great that we're able to have this discussion today to hopefully release some underlying stigma around what obesity and what healthy is supposed to feel.
Yeah. And one of the things I typically like to start with when I'm talking about this topic, because like you said, there are a lot of different ideas about it. And so I usually like to start with this idea of addressing the language and the terminology that we use around it, especially the language that I'll use. So I acknowledge that there is an ongoing discussion about what compassionate language to use regarding obesity. So the current prevailing view, especially in the science literature, is that we want to use person-centered language, such as a child with obesity. But there are other views suggesting that just the term obesity in itself is medicalizing, and it makes being fat seem like a disease, or it's assumed to be this negative thing. And so while I don't view fatness or larger bodies in that light, I do typically use the term obesity, and I will likely in this podcast as well, because it is considered current best practice, but with that recognition that can change.
Yeah. And I think as a society, you don't hear that word at all, because it's something that we just aren't supposed to say. We say, but somehow obese in like a normal sense is okay to say. And it's the terminology and what we can and can't say is something that is very much stuck in a generational change, a generational use as well. I know that my grandparents and often sort of use that term not as anything bad or anything negative, but just as a factual thing. Whereas we today, when I'm hearing it, it's very much a, okay, that's a very offensive, it's an offensive term, but to them, it's a very normal thing to say, or it's a normal, okay, this is what factually, this is what it is. And that huge conversation between generations is going to definitely change and offend a lot of people.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of language out there, and not every term resonates with everybody. And so it's okay to have differing views with this understanding of coming together, focusing on the issue at hand, but without it being from this place of trying to medicalize or trying to be negative about it. It's just that we use different terms and people have different preferences for how they want to identify.
No, that's very true. And especially in today's society, in today's culture, there's a lot of different ways that people resonate with a certain term. So I think it's important that I'm glad that we sort of had that disclaimer out before we started the show, sort of like set ease of both of us and like, okay, we didn't say that beforehand. So it's glad that we did.
Yeah, we can say all the words and it's an okay place to be doing that.
Yes, it's a little safe space today, which is good. So to start off with, I love to get to know some of your interests as well as some of your recommendations with playing our show's favorite game, A Little Icebreaker. Now, to start off with, what is the most recent book that you've read?
This is going to seem kind of lame, but my most recent book was by Sophie Hagen. It's called Happy Fat. It's Taking Up Space in a World That Wants to Shrink You. So Sophie is a comedian and she uses this book to talk about fat phobia in her daily life and how she's kind of found her own self-acceptance in it, especially with all the like judgment that she faced. And it's just a good book.
No, it sounds, I love hearing it from the perspective of someone as well, rather than just, okay, this is all the factual stuff. So to know that this is what she's experienced and to talk about her own experiences, I feel it's something that will calm a lot of people who are sort of feeling that same way as well.
Yes. One of the things I like about it so much too is that you're not alone in this. Like this, and basically everything, someone's experiencing it with you. And so getting to read about it, seeing it represented somewhere is important and it helps us feel validated.
No, I completely agree. Now, next up is, what is a movie that you would recommend to our viewers?
So the thing that comes to my mind as a graduate student and just working right now, I don't have a lot of time for movies. So I have an ongoing list, basically, of movies that I want to watch. And some of those that I've included on there are documentaries about food lobbying. So there's something called Sugar Coated, and then there's another one called Fed Up. And they're not new. They've been around for a while. I just haven't gotten the chance to watch them yet. But those are two that I really want to catch up on and watch.
I think I've heard, are they on Netflix by any chance?
I think they are. So access is easier.
Yeah, that's probably why I have heard of it. It's on my list as well. My list, like yours, is growing very long and I somehow end up repeating the same shows over and over and over again without trying anything new. But no, I'm very much in your space where that's on my list of two things to watch because I think The Sugar Coated I've heard is really good. So, but I just have to sit down and actually listen to it right now. There's no time for that.
I did watch Barbie, so I am up to date with some movies.
Okay, well, that's good. We'll take that. Now, could you name a podcast that stands out to you, either professionally or in a personal sense?
Yeah, so as part of my training, I also teach introductory to psychology courses. And one of the assignments I always give my students is to listen to the Psychology World podcast. They have a great one on health psychology and the biopsychosocial model. And I really recommend this to students because it's a great introduction to a model for health psychology that incorporates a more holistic approach to how we conceptualize health problems. And so that one in particular, it's easy, it's digestible, and I do highly recommend it.
Oh, that's Perfect. No, that sounds very interesting. I love the world of psychology. I think it's so fascinating to me. For now, my big interest is child psychology. So, I mean, obviously with this podcast, it's going to be quite hard to sort of get away from it from now. But no, I think it's just understanding how someone works is very interesting.
And one of the things I like about the biopsychosocial model and understanding people is that it really takes, it's literally in the name. It's looking at the biology, the genetics, it's looking on the psychology, and then it's also considering all those system and social level factors. And I think we sometimes forget when we're thinking about an individual's presenting problems, essentially in a clinic setting, we forget that there's all these different things going on in their life that brought them to where they are and that's impacting them as a whole person.
No, that's very true. I think we don't really look at it until we really need to look at it. So no, it's very fascinating. Now, during your academic achievements, academic pursuits, what's been one course that has really stuck to you and really molded you into the kind of person that you're wanting to be in your professional world?
Yeah. So in my training, I've taken courses to meet the requirements for like our clinical child as well as pediatric psychology. And through that, I was able to complete all of the training and like seminar courses for a particular certification in parent-child interaction therapy, or PCIT. And I really enjoy being able to provide this service to families. It really focuses on that parent-child relationship and building that bond between the caregiver and the child, and then empowering the parent to be the person who's giving the like therapy to their child. It's teaching the parent the skills so that they can go home and understand like how to use these skills to properly discipline their child or praise their child and reinforce them. And so it's a great way of working with families, but really allowing the parent to be the one in control and focusing on helping child outcomes through empowering the parent. And so that was something that I take with me. And even though it's technically a specific therapy type, you can incorporate those skills in so many things that when you're working with families.
Yeah, that's honestly what I've heard about psychology, and especially a lot of those psychology courses, is the fact that you can really intertwine it in so many different ways. And while the specific topic is of one sort of genre, the techniques that you learn and the theory that you learn can be pretty much turned into so many different aspects of it as well. So it's really interesting. Honestly, psychology is probably one of my favorite little obsessions currently. In a little research, I'm going to research this in my own kind of way. So the courses sound absolutely incredible every time I hear about them.
Well, the podcasts are helpful because it's like you're getting a glimpse into these classes without having to go back to school.
Exactly. I could not go back to school now.
One day I will get to say that.
Yeah, good luck. Have fun with that.
Yes.
So now we're going to be looking into our little interview and looking into how parenting sort of works, especially when it comes to the topic today. But how do we know what parenting is? And I know that everyone's definition for parenting is very different. What would your definition of parenting be?
Yeah. So thinking broadly, parenting is about providing children safety and nutrition and supporting their physical, emotional, social, and cognitive development to prepare them for adulthood. So there are a lot of books out there that tell you how to parent, but what works for one family or even just one child doesn't work for another. And even so, there are some key strategies that we know are beneficial for the majority of children. And so when we think about parenting, there's certain things like having routines or using household rules, appropriate discipline without harshness, that are important, including showing warmth and sensitivity. And so when we think about parenting broadly like that, we're able to use these key strategies to support development in all of these different areas for the child.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think that expectant parents need to be aware of through their transition into being a parent?
Yeah. So whenever I work with parents and families, and some of them are new parents, some of them have been parents for years, I like to remind them that it's okay to want help, it's okay to need help, and it's okay to ask for support. People don't magically become infallible when they become parents. You don't need to know everything. And this is why it's so important to have access to systems of care, because then you have access to people who are experts in various areas to support your family, to support your child, because it takes a village.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I think especially when it comes to, we talk about, okay, first time parents being needing to know a whole lot of information, but third time parents, second time parents is still a whole lot of stuff that they didn't experience the first or second time round, or they didn't really feel the first or second time round. Their child may be reacting to things differently than they've had experiences with. So there's a whole lot of things that is still needing to be learned. And I think a lot of people aren't really aware of that up until something is actually happening that they're unsure about.
Mm-hmm. And then there's this pressure if it is your third child and all of a sudden you're having more difficulty with that particular child, there's this pressure to figure it out yourself because, hey, you've already raised two kids, shouldn't you know? And that in itself is so problematic because you don't need to fight this battle on your own.
No, that's very true. Now, looking into some of the concepts that we're going to be looking into, I want to get to know some of the definitions from you a little bit more just before we dive into it. Now, how would you define or even explain the concept of obesity in children for our listeners?
Yeah. So to define obesity, much of the work on obesity is categorized by body mass index or BMI. BMI is calculated using an individual's weight and height. And for children, they also use the child's age and sex. But this in itself, BMI, is a flawed measurement. And the American Medical Association has admitted that the BMI is racist. And so instead, how individuals and families define health can look very different. Thinking medically, though, obesity is categorized when a child's BMI is equal to or greater than the 95th percentile. So essentially, when you are at your pediatrician's office, your pediatrician might use a growth chart to track your child's physical development. And this growth chart would show how a child should grow, I say, you know, provided these optimal conditions. And the idea is that the growth charts will help providers plot and measure your child's growth, allowing for that comparison with healthy children of that same gender, sex, and age. And when a child's BMI score is in the 95th percentile or greater, they're considered in this obesity category. And there are ways for you to calculate your own BMI as well as your child's BMI at home. Online, there's a lot of resources for that. And but when we think about a child's weight and growth, we want to recognize that there are it's impacted by multiple factors. So that includes genetics, nutrition, environment, chronic disease, trauma, so much more. And neither the growth chart nor a BMI score should be used as a single measurement of long-term weight status or what we consider as like a healthy person.
No, it's very interesting because when I joined the gym pretty late. And when we're talking about, okay, we're going to go and weigh you, they didn't put me on like a regular scale like you sort of expect when you first join the gym. I think I was about 18 or 19 when I first entered a gym, first really saw what the inside of a gym looks like. And there's that whole, okay, I'm going to weigh you. They didn't put us on a natural, like, okay, bathroom scale, we're going to weigh you, see what it looks like. They put me on like a BMI scale and they were actually showing bone density. They were showing so many different factors that included with
weight. And they said that my bones are a lot more denser than normal. And that added to the weight that I grew up thinking that I had. And that was that whole, okay, I was on the bathroom scale for like 18 years of my life, seeing, okay, this is how much I weighed, not being happy about it. And the minute I entered the gym, there was that complete safety net where it's like, okay, that's not really what reality is. That's not really what, there's so many different factors that go into how much you weigh or how heavy you are. There's so many different areas to it that no one really tells you unless you ask for it.
Yeah, those machines are really helpful, exactly why you're saying, because it gives you a more, like we're saying, like a bigger picture. And it's not just this one number on a scale. It's all these different things that make up your overall health. And it's really nice because it'll show you your muscles, your bone density, water retention, and all these different things that impact your weight that you can't tell just from a regular bathroom scale.
Yeah. No, it was so interesting at the how much you sort of learned about your body. But it's crazy that it's not such a normal thing that's really spoken about. Like, we hear a bathroom scale being like the easiest way to see how heavy you are. And generationally, that's what has been done. But there's so much more to it that is not commonly known unless you really go and seek it out yourself.
Or you decide to go to school for it.
Exactly. And it's so fascinating to me at the fact that we don't have that option for kids unless they really go and say, okay, this is what's available, this is what you should go and see. So it's amazing to me that when we hear about okay, you need to go on a diet because you weigh this certain weight, there's so much more to it that, okay, the fat, but you might have like a 40% fat attached to you, but your bone density is heavier than most people, or it's heavier than normal, or it's the heaviest part to you. But because you're on a bathroom scale, you weigh all of that plus added to each other, and that's how much you weigh.
Mm-hmm. And also this like idea that you can tell someone's health just by this number on a scale, this weight, because weight doesn't equal healthy. Skinny doesn't equal healthy. And so there is this idea of even the people are telling you, oh, you need to lose weight, you need to go on a diet. That's not necessarily going to make you healthier. And that sort of idea needs to be a little disconnected.
Yeah. No, I've learned that the hard way. I think growing up, going into adulthood, learned so much about understanding how healthy my body is, plus how happy my body is. And there's that whole expectation that the amount of weight that lifted off my chest the minute that I figured out that I can actually control, I can actually eat and I can actually enjoy things that I eat. And there's so much that you don't learn when you're younger. And well, at least I didn't learn that when I was younger. I had no idea about, okay, taking care of my body and what would that entail, mainly because that wasn't easy access to. I mean, yes, it was shown in schools, but it was shown, okay, healthy eating, eat an apple, eat fruit. But like that necessarily cancel out the entire issue about understanding what your body means and what each part of your body does and how it all equals together.
Right. And when we think about health and even just weight, there's so many factors that impact weight too. So if we're just thinking about your mental health, your sleep that you're getting, the amount of physical activity you're doing, all these different things also impact weight. And so when you narrow in and just think, oh, you need to change your diet, you need to do this or that, and all of a sudden you'll be better, that it's not realistic. And it just sets people up for disappointment and to feel like they're not meeting these made up goals that people have provided or social media has provided.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, don't get me started on social media's impact. We could be here for hours just talking about that.
Yeah, that is now, a whole other ball game.
Yeah. Now, with the amount of obesity that's sort of turned up in children and has become an issue worldwide, what are some of the key factors that could contribute to this problem? And why is it important for families to sort of address it collectively?
Yeah, so when we think about health and obesity, like I said, it's impacted by many factors. So that could include family history, the genetics, the amount of sleep, your eating patterns, the level of physical activity you're doing. And so within families, creating a family routine that incorporates healthy goals can be helpful. And addressing lifestyle behaviors as a family helps everyone feel supported, almost like you're all in this together. And the choices that you guys are making are going to help everyone in the family. It's not targeted towards just the one person with, like, quote, problem, unquote. And so when we create healthy habits and we do them as a family, it has an impact on making the changes more long term. But then when we think about other factors that might be contributing to the increase in obesity, we also want to consider the system level. And so we know that obesity is influenced by the food environment, how affordable healthy food and beverages are, people's access to grocery stores, to fresh food, and the availability of safe public recreational facilities to do that physical activity. And so while we want to focus on things in the family, there's also this understanding that parents can't do it all alone. There needs to be a system level as well.
No, that's very true. And I think parents can only do so much. Yes, that they're an example, but also that in a way they're unreliable example because they're still learning about it too. Like if I had kids, I'm still learning about it. There's no way that I could be the main source of a child's view into what healthy eating and healthy habits is because I can spend hours Googling for myself, but I don't know how to teach that to someone else. So there's like a lack of, especially from what I've seen in schools, like we have, I think in Australia, there's this giraffe that comes to you around school and it's called like Healthy Harold and teaches you how to be healthy, healthy eating and healthy habits. But that feels like 2 hours just in a trailer trying to understand what this giraffe is telling you about healthy eating. So there's not like the amount of view that you would need for a child to consistently be aware of how much this is impacting you, how much it can impact you both short-term and long-term.
Yeah, and we know with like when we think about child development, we know that children aren't the best at thinking about long-term planning. That's just they're not at that executive functioning ability yet. And so a lot of it does fall on the parents. And there is a lot of pressure for the parents to be that ideal model and show their kid how to do it. And while that is really true, parents have so much that they can pass down to their children. The child is also in so many other environments than just the home. They're surrounded by so many other things that those also need to be targets for changes or interventions to focus on health and how we as a society conceptualize health.
Yes. And there's so much wrong information as well. There's some things that, okay, but that's all a parent can provide or that's all a parent knows. Like, especially when you come to, unless you go to a dietitian and you and your whole family go on a family trip to go see a dietitian and see how to collectively learn about healthy habits, it's not information that is out for the wide public. It's information that one person is telling you if you go seek it out. So especially when it comes to the whole, the silent sort of epidemic of obesity that we're sort of seeing worldwide, there's not a lot of information that's there constantly to remind us of what to do, constantly to remind us, okay, this is what you should focus on. And especially if kids don't see it constantly as well, there's not going to be that, okay, I'm going to go see it. Oh, sorry, reminding me to go and eat an apple. Oh, it's reminding me to go and maybe I should go for a walk, or maybe we can go for a bike ride all together as a family. There's, unless you all have that initiative to do that, which if you have that as a family, that's amazing. And I know, especially with COVID, it made it a little bit easier to go for walks or take time for yourself or sort of relax a little bit more and do things. But the world is now up and running again, which means that we're now having to constantly be ahead and constantly keep working and do the same thing practically that we did before the whole other epidemic happened in the world.
Right. And it's interesting that you bring that up, because when we think about weight discrimination, it is unfortunately a form of discrimination that is almost socially acceptable, because there aren't consequences to discriminating against weight, not in all environments. And there's some headway that has been made on that, but largely this discrimination is supported by such intertwined stereotypes into the way that we think about weight, the way we think about fat, and the way that we want to approach these like health problems.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, what are some of the misconceptions or some of the myths that you find yourself seeing on a constant basis when it comes to childhood obesity and healthy eating and healthy habits that you would like to talk about?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked this, because a lot of my research is on weight stigma. And so one of the biggest misconceptions that sort of hit home for me is about weight discrimination. And it's the idea that if we stigmatize and discriminate against those with higher weight, that this will motivate them to lose weight. Instead, there are well-established studies like Tomiyama and colleagues' 2018 work that suggests that the experience of weight bias and fat shaming actually increases the risk of weight gain. So what this tells us is that whether it's well-intentioned or not, evoking stigma to motivate someone to lose weight is actually doing the opposite. And so when we think about it, adults and children are facing this stigma, these stereotypes, this discrimination, almost on a daily level. And so people have this misconception that people's excess weight is the individual's fault and they just aren't working hard enough. And people have biases that people with higher weight might have poor hygiene or are not smart. And there's so much literature out there dating back. So when we think about Crandall's 1991 and 1995 work, these papers even found that daughters with higher weight were offered less financial support for college. And so weight stigma itself has these serious effects as feeling on feeling rejected by peers, family members. We can see higher rates of depression and anxiety just from the experience of weight stigma, not even connected to the actual weight. And this could lead to harmful weight control practices like disordered eating. And so a lot of my doctoral research focused on weight-related stigma on the parents for their children's weight. And so when we think about parents, they've sometimes reported feeling stigmatized by others. That's not a shock. But this might happen at doctor's offices, specifically for their children's weight. And there are some studies that show that parents especially feel blamed for their child having excess weight. And so in my research, I wanted to compare this to parents with what we consider like healthy or typical weight. When people are provided no additional information about the child, about the family, all I tell them through this very structured protocol, but the only information they're given is that the child has obesity, people view the parents of the child with higher weight as a worse parent. And they view those parents as more responsible for their children's weight and associate them to have more obesity-related stereotypes. And so when we think that even just with this one nugget of information, there's all these like stereotypes that are coming out, the impact of weight stigma is massive, and it's having this like daily impact on people.
It's sad that you say that, because there's that whole way that we're sort of trying to not do that, especially in workplaces where there's a, we're trying to be more diverse. We're trying to be more of one of everyone. It shouldn't matter. But when you think about it, society really does care. And that's the really sad part. And society really does judge. Like, we see it in films, we see it in movies, of any parent that doesn't look like the typical parent, or the child that doesn't act like a typical child, it's somehow the parent's fault, or somehow the parent is, there is the person of that's ridiculed throughout the whole film. And there's, you think that in a society that we are today, where we're being a whole lot more accepting, we're trying to be a whole lot more accepting, you'd think that we'd be a little bit more aware of what you can do to damage the child and the parent's mental health, and damage the whole idea of, okay, should I really be saying this about someone? And what does it have to, one, what does it have to do with you? For one question. This two is that a productive thing to say? Is it going to make a change? Is it going to help them to make a change? No, it's literally going to make them feel worse. Just thinking, like, when you think about, we're trying to help everyone's mental health, and we're such a big kick on mental health now, you think that those questions would be the first two that you'd ask when you're about to say something about someone, or about to ridicule someone for just trying to make it through the day.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting when we think about, like, modeling and parents modeling behaviors, there's also self discrimination when it comes to weight. Like, you are internalizing this weight stigma. And so every time that you're talking about a problem area, or you're talking about, like, oh, I shouldn't have that cake that I really want, this, like, restrictive eating, you are also modeling that way of thinking, those relationships with food, which do have long-term impacts on your child, but also it's impacting you as well as the parent, as an individual. And if we really stop and think about it, is it helpful? Are you happy when you have thoughts like that? Or do you make yourself feel bad? And if you are, why are we doing it?
No, exactly. And it's funny, because I was at a store over on the weekend, and there was the mother shopping for their teenage daughter, who is slightly growing out of her clothes. She's needing bigger sizes. And the daughter is like, no, I want a size 10. I want a size 8. The mother is trying to tell her that she's a size 12 to 14. And the daughter looked so humiliated. And it was like, it was more than just a little bit of humiliation. The mom was so comfortable with it. She was saying, okay, well, we can go up sizes. And she's like, no, I want something that I'm supposed to be this size. And you could see it around you. Everyone around her was just looking at the mom and saying that, why are you making your daughter feel so bad? But it's like, this, she's growing up a size. She's getting older. She doesn't have to be a size 8 or a size 10. She can be a size 14 to 16 and it being completely fine. But we've normalized, especially in clothing, we've normalized weight changes. And like, okay, because you are size 14, you should have to go shop somewhere else. Or like, we've normalized that in so many situations that it's now shameful for a lot of teenage girls, especially to, and I've only experienced with my sister, and I haven't really experienced on the other side of how boys feel when it comes to weight as well. But from what I've seen personally, there's that huge stigma around, okay, I have to be an 8'10". I have to be that size. If I can't fit to that size, then I can't buy anything until I get to that size.
Mm-hmm. And when we think about clothing in particular, it's interesting that we normalize, like, this number, this size that we're supposed to be, but the sizing of clothing is so varied. The sizing of clothing is not normalized. So when you're saying, oh, I have to have something that's a size 8, the way it fits, the actual measurements are going to vary so much across different stores, brands, types of clothes. And so we're shaming ourselves. It's so much internalized weight stigma when we think about the clothes that we have to wear, or that, oh, I'm keeping that clothing in the back of my closet for when I'm that size. And again, it's only hurting yourself every time you look at it.
Yeah. And it's hard to imagine that they're just clothes, because I feel that same way as well. Even I'm 25 and I'm shopping in a store, and sometimes I'm like, oh, I can't fit in a size 14. Okay, should I get the 14 and then I can go to the gym and lose weight, and then I'll be able to fit in size 14. I've done that a few times of the clothes that I still have to this day, and I'm still like staring at it. I have not fit into it yet. And I'm staring at it. It's like, okay, I'm just doing this to myself. I'm damaging myself by not being able to fit into this and having it stare at me in the face saying that I'm not there yet, or I'm not able to fit into it. And I still growing to be comfortable in sizes. I can only imagine being a teenager. Like when it comes to the different genders as well, like how does the, I've only had us, like I'm only talking about one side, but how is it when it comes to teenage boys going through that? Have you sort of seen the difference in the way that they manage their sort of weight experience or acceptance, or the different sides to that?
Mm-hmm. So what I do know, and my knowledge about this is a little bit limited because I don't really look at sex differences and weight stigma, but what we do know is that women tend to feel more weight stigma. They do tend to have higher consequences for weight stigma. But you're right, it could look different. So if we think about the psychological impacts, let's use for example, when we think about the prevalence rates of depression or anxiety and how it presents in girls versus boys, if it's partly impacted by weight stigma, the presentation of their symptoms might look different. So even if the cause is the same, they're both being impacted by weight stigma, the way that it shows up might look different, which might cloud our understanding of how much weight stigma is impacting boys versus girls if it looks different in them.
Mm-hmm. And I know that many parents feel overwhelmed. Like I know seeing that mother in that store, I could see her being overwhelmed and trying to understand what to say. And there's never a really good way of saying, okay, you've gained weight, and trying to make the daughter feel better about that. There's, especially being a mother, there's that whole sort of expectation is like, I don't know what to say. I have no idea how to calm her down. If some parents feel that overwhelmed or unsure about where to start, what are some simple and practical steps families can take to sort of start their journey to learn a bit more about their bodies and to learn a bit more about, okay, how can I differentiate between bone density and water retention and all that stuff in your body?
Well, first, especially with your example, I do like to pause and validate that mom or that any parent who's in this like public setting and feels like all eyes on them, they don't know how to respond, their child is doing something that's evoking more eyes on them. It's a really uncomfortable situation to be in. You feel that, and you just want to get out of that. And so it might lead to reactions that you don't necessarily want or didn't mean to say. And this is why, like you were saying, it's so important to have that consistency. So the language, the way that we're talking about weight, the openness that we discuss weight and what health really looks like and how health can be defined differently, those conversations need to happen across environments consistently. These conversations can't just start in these really high stressful situations. They need to have conversations like this at home where it is safe and where everybody's in a good mood and you can talk about these things in a more comfortable setting, so that later when these situations do arise, because unfortunately they do, those lessons, those things that the children have already heard, some of it stuck. We don't always see it right away, but some of the stuff we've said sticks with them. And so when we think about being overwhelmed, wanting practical steps on how to begin this like journey for lifestyle changes, it is really hard to change everything at once. That is incredibly overwhelming. And it is just a recipe for it not working, for feeling disappointed, feeling like you failed at something. And instead, what we want to do is come up with realistic, achievable goals. And so breaking things down. So for example, if one of your goals as a family, let's say you eat out 7 days a week. So every day of a week, you typically have at least one meal out. If you suddenly said, we're never going to eat out again, like that we're cutting it cold turkey, that is incredibly hard. Not only is it hard because you'll miss those foods because you're restricting, but also there's so much time now you're devoting to meal prepping, to grocery shopping, for cooking. And then also you have to clean those dishes after. So like just cutting it out isn't really realistic because that's adding so much time very quickly. And that is very overwhelming. And so one of the practical ways that I like to recommend families is start at a number that works for you. So if it's 7 days a week right now, you're eating out, let's try four. And, you know, let's do 4 days a week. You can still eat out, but the other days, let's try not to. And we can try that for like 2 weeks. And those numbers obviously will change based on an individual family situation. But if you can master that, that motivation that that you start to feel, there's almost this like, okay, I can do the next thing. I can cut one more day. I can do this. And starting small and building these changes over time builds that consistency. You're doing it as a family. And all of this will impact these changes becoming a lifestyle change. And so these little habits, these little steps that we take, there is a greater purpose. There is this like long-term goal that you have in mind. And again, children may not see it right away. It might need to be guided by the parents and by the family and by the providers, you know, being that support for them. But then that is going to help us get to closer to the end of that journey.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we build those, like you said, building those habits sort of take a lot of time, takes a lot of consistency, trying to keep at it. What are some practical strategies for maintaining that motivation to try to get better or try to learn from your previous mistakes?
One of the things that I typically will say, so I'll say it because you said it, they are opportunities for learning rather than mistakes. And so this idea that we set a goal, maybe we didn't hit it. What do we need to change? Like what got in the way for us not to be able to do it this time? Okay, let's try it again. Or maybe we need to cut it back a little. Maybe 4 days was just not, that was still too much. Maybe now we try five. Like let's change it back up, try that again. And so just making those adjustments because life throws so much at you. And 1 week might look different from the other week. So yeah, you might have set this goal, but now there's this crisis and your whole schedule is off, your routine is off. And that is just the way life goes. And so having a lifestyle change means having this like flexibility and being able to adjust to that and almost showing yourself that like compassion and flexibility for yourself that, okay, yeah, maybe I didn't need it this week, but we can try again. There's no reason why we can't.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a parent, there's a lot of stuff that you sort of recognize as signs for potential obesity in a child or the potential to sort of, okay, this child is not really looking on the healthy side or trying to eat on the healthier side or trying to understand their own body. How and when should they seek professional help in order to allow the child to build their own confidence?
Yeah, so one of the benefits of those growth charts is that your pediatrician should have eyes on where your child is growing, what that path looks like. And so there's this more consistent monitoring of your child's health and their weight. But then there's also certain things or things that are associated with obesity that if you notice your child starting to do, it might be a time to visit the pediatrician again. So children with obesity might also experience sleep apnea, snoring, excessive fatigue. They might even have really bad acid reflux or joint pain. So if they start noticing that they're walking less or it's hurting to walk and it's preventing them from being active, these are all concerns to bring up with your providers. And it's really beneficial when the parents are partners with providers on setting up plans and services, because your family is, you're going to know best what is going to work for your family. And so we want to work with the providers to set up these goals and these services. And that might mean being referred to a GI specialist. It might mean going to see a dietitian, like you said earlier. But having all these different domains or areas of a child being looked at, having eyes on them could help. And then your question about what age, those growth charts can start pretty, they start from birth. So if you start noticing that your child is growing way off what the expected growth plan is, you can start noting these concerns. You can start having conversations about, okay, what can we do in the household to maybe help work on this before it becomes an issue? But we see like children, even at the age of 4 years old, who can really benefit from some of these skill and lifestyle changes and starting to incorporate them even that young too.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's amazing that that's the amount of help that's available as well, especially from a young age. So the availability for that to, so it's not relying completely on the parents, which is great. It's going to ease a lot of parents' minds as well, knowing that they're also getting a second opinion. They're also getting a lot of help that is just not completely reliant on them to try to understand. So no, that's great.
And there's also this like idea that, oh, if my child's obese, then they're just eating everything. But that's not necessarily the case. We also see a lot of picky eating or feeding problems. And so then that's another great way to talk with your pediatrician to get those referrals, because there are people who have expertise in helping with picky eating, who have expertise in helping with those like feeding and eating behaviors. And like you're saying, it can be hard for a parent to do that when every mealtime turns into a battle to get your child to eat one thing. There might be other tactics that you can use to help not only get your child to eat the things that are more nutritious and the what you want them to eat, but also to help your child's build that autonomy to learn and create their own relationship with food starts at a very young age.
No, that's very true. And that's very good to hear that there's that kind of support. Now, we're going to move on to our practice and habit part of the show. Now, what is a practice that you do to motivate yourself to find a balance with your own autonomy?
Yeah. So I've said this before, it's busy. Life is hard. And sometimes I feel like I have very limited time, and it does feel easier to just pick up fast food. And this might describe other people's lives too, where, you know, it'll save me time. I'll just go and grab something. And I, in a way to try and help myself decrease the amount of time I was eating out, I did try meal prepping before. And the first time I tried to meal prep, it did not go so well. I learned about myself that I cannot have the same meal every day. I am unhappy, and it makes me not want to eat it. And so, of course, at first I had that initial feeling of like, oh my God, I failed at this. I can't do it. And then there's this realization that the way I meal prep doesn't have to look like what other people do. It doesn't have to look like what those TikTok shows. I can adjust my meal prepping to fit my life. And so now the practice that I do is I do meal prep now, but I only make about 3 or 4 meals and only enough to last about 4 or 5 days. And that flexibility, those last couple of days in the week, that gives me space to try to make something different if I want variety, or to go eat out with my friends and to go enjoy food with others. Because if we have that rigidity about, oh, I have to eat this meal, it can also be limiting and restrictive.
Well, thank God someone else found the same thing about meal prep that I did. Oh, yeah, I cannot eat the same thing every day. And I, like you, I tried that. It was fun the first 2 days. And I think the third day I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to buy something.
And like, some people, it works for some people. It really does. Chicken, yeah. Vegetables, rice, whatever. Like, they are good to go. But, you know, we're all a little different. We just got to figure out what works for us.
Exactly. No, so I'm glad someone else. So when you said that relates to someone, yeah, that related to me quite a lot. So that's good.
I'm glad.
Now, when it comes to meal prepping, what are some of the challenges that you did find when you went about this job, other than the lack of variety that sort of comes in?
Yeah, it took hours. Like, I will be very honest. I have to dedicate so many hours over the weekend to make the meals. But then there's also the day where I have to go pick up all the groceries and the day where I have to plan the meals I'm going to make. And so there's all this like time that I'm devoting to this. And so I have to have the time to do it, the mental capacity, the load to be able to handle that week. And so that can be challenging, especially as life throws you different things, different obstacles each week. You know, some weeks it might work and some weeks it might not. And that's okay. At least you eat healthy sometimes. Like, there's no reason why not being able to do it one weekend doesn't prevent me from doing it the following weekend. Even though it does take a lot of time, I do like to remind myself that it is a labor of love for myself, for future me.
You're putting in that early investment.
Yes. Put the hours in now so that future me can come home from work and just pop something in the microwave, and I will be very happy in the future.
No, that sounds really good. I honestly think one of the other challenges for me was how expensive it is as well. Like, the pricing between, okay, I'm going to get fast food or I'm going to get something quick that I can just buy for about $4 or $5. There's that whole, okay, you're going to go and buy fresh groceries. You're going to go and buy the rice that's needed, the chicken that's needed, the veggies that's needed, and the amount that it costs, it's twice as much as you would go. And like, added that with time, meal prepping seemed like the most hardest thing to do in throughout the week.
I will say, as the price of things have increased, the price of fast food has also increased. And so now there's this, and I find myself asking myself this question of, is it, if it's going to cost me the same, is it worth getting the fast food? Like, do I want to spend $25 at a fast food restaurant, or I could just go to the grocery store and get enough for like 3 days? Because you can buy more things and the ingredients make more items. And so I guess the price of things has helped me meal prep more, as sad as that is. And then also, like, and this is, I recognize a privilege of mine, is that I can afford to buy the bulk items so that I can spend more upfront because I have the means to do that, because then it'll prep me to have the ingredients I need later. And sometimes when you buy in bulk, it does come out cheaper, but it does mean you have to have the ability to do that in that moment.
No, that's very true. And how often do you do it? Once a week that you sort of set the time to do it?
Yeah, so I fortunately have my weekends off where I'm not working, and so I am able to do Saturday as my like grocery day, and then Sunday is the day I cook. I don't like to do it in one day because then I get very upset. I get annoyed that I'm spending all my time doing that. And so that's another thing I learned, that I like to split it. So Saturday I'll go grocery shopping, I'll do something else, and then Sunday I'll cook, and then I'll have time to do something else. So my whole day is not used up by this meal prepping schedule.
That's That's good. You learn from experience. It's mm-hmm. a good thing.
Yeah.
Now, we're into our last section of the show, which is the open mic. And it gets you to talk about something that you are passionate about. It doesn't have to be related to what we're talking about today, but it definitely can be. So in the last minute or so, I'd love to hear your thoughts as to what you'd like to share with us today.
Yeah, so I'm currently in my final year of training. And so we are required to do sort of an internship or residency year. And I'm spending mine right now at an autism and neurodevelopment clinic, where I am learning the skills to complete autism assessment and work with a neurodiverse population. And this has been something that I've loved to do. It kind of relates to obesity and eating behaviors, because we know that executive functioning is associated with eating behaviors. And children who are neurodiverse typically have deficits or difficulties with executive functioning. And so it is a little bit interconnected, but I do have this passion essentially for working with this population and bridging that a little bit. And so through this residency year, I've also gotten to work with some faculty members who do pediatric obesity with this population, and gotten to do some projects that look at eating behaviors in neurodiverse children and the patterns of eating behaviors and how they might differ if we think about executive functioning. And are there certain eating behaviors that these kiddos are doing more? And if that is the case, then maybe our interventions for weight management don't work quite as well with this population, and getting to look at that a little bit more. And so that is something that I've really enjoyed doing during this last year.
No, that sounds like a really rewarding and also really learning curve for you when it comes to what you want to get out of it as well. There's a lot of things that you possibly can. So that sounds a really incredible learning experience.
Yeah, and I think that's also what has helped open my own eyes to all the resources and things that are available. Because when we think about neurodiversity, there are also difficulties with feeding, and there's feeding disorders, and there are resources to help with that. Even just speech and occupational therapists can help with the motor skills that are required for eating and picky eating. And so there are all these little things that other experts have knowledge about that can target little things that might be beneficial to any family.
No, it sounds incredible to be able to be a part of that and just to see it firsthand and experience it. It sounds amazing. Well, thank you so much, Devanshi, for joining me on the show today and for sharing a lot of your own expertise and a lot of your own experiences and learning journeys as well throughout the stigma of obesity and understanding what healthy really means. And I love that we've made it a conversation. I mean, I have a list of questions here and we barely answered them in a question and answer form, because it was so much that I think we just related to a whole lot, and a lot of the own personal journeys and personal understandings really made it what it was today.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be able to talk about this and know that there's going to be people out there listening who hopefully can take something away from it.
Now, if there's a way that audiences would like to get in contact with you to either ask questions that I didn't get to asking or maybe could have expanded on a little bit more, do you have contact information that I'm able to give out to them?
Yes. So I have an email address that they can contact me at. And I'll give a personal email address rather than a school affiliated, just because eventually I will lose the school affiliated email. So they can contact me at my first name, Devanshi, Devanshi, the letter P as in Paul, and then 57@gmail.com. And I'm happy to talk or answer any questions if someone wanted to contact me.
Oh, that's perfect. Well, I'll have that down in the description for easy access for a lot of our audiences. And that's exactly where it's going to be. So definitely go and check it out. And thank you again, Devanshi, for joining me on the show today. It's been amazing talking about this. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. I'll see you all in the next episode.
You've been listening to Raising Parents, the Parenting Science Insights podcast, produced by the Parenting Science Labs, a division of LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. More episodes are available from 10 life management perspectives and can be found by searching LMSL on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and other podcasting apps available on your devices. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating our show, sharing it, and subscribing to our channel, as it helps other people find it so that we can grow and bring you more quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website at pa.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Dina Sargent. Thanks for tuning in.